find a Bigfoot.
How about the lost city of Atlantis, then?
Isn't that...
Jeffrey Pritchett, bringing you the High Strange. Visit www.churchofmabusradio.com. That's www.churchofmabusradio.com.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Benetti, and along with Joe Montaldo, we co-host a new show called News on the Flip Side. You can catch us every Saturday night, 8 p.m. Central, where we will be discussing current events and topics going on in the world today. We have opinions on everything. There's no topic that we won't discuss at places that other shows wouldn't dare. False history gets made all day, every day. The truth of the new is never on the news, but you can catch it here, News on the Flip Side, only on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Welcome to A Global Focus with guest Neil Gould, a director of the Exopolitics Institute and creator of the Exopolitics Hong Kong website. Topics will include Exo News on Exopolitics Field and Reach Developments, Exopolitics Hong Kong, Project Mexo, UFO Sightings, continuing response to Neil's book, and update on Neil's project to manufacture a series of fuel cells to be retrofitted into cars, trucks, and buses, run on water to reduce emissions and save mileage. Welcome, everyone, to A Global Focus. Tree Sheridan speaking. Our featured guest for this evening, October 5th, 2012, is Neil Gould, who is joining us from Hong Kong, where it is now 9 a.m. Saturday morning. The Global Focus program is broadcast on the UPRN network at 107.9 FM New Orleans and on the international web. We are heard in many countries across the globe. Thanks to Joe Montaldo, UPRN network owner, for making these programs possible. Also thanks to my pastor for sending out this week a prayer request to hundreds for a dear friend with a very aggressive cancer. In addition to our listeners, don't forget that Joe Montaldo, ICAR International Director and host of UFO Undercover, will be speaking at the USA Hot Springs October 12th through the 14th Crystal and Crystal Skull Festival at Hot Springs, Arkansas. Now, further conference details on this event, October 12th through the 14th, can be found at the Facebook page entitled Hot Springs Second Annual Crystal and Crystal Skull Festival. Sounds like a wonderful and very informative weekend. Now, let's get back to the Global Focus interview for this evening. Tonight's discussion with Neil Gould will include the following topics: Exo News on Exopolitics Field and Research Developments, Exopolitics Hong Kong, Project Mexo, Sightings, UFO Sightings, the continuing response to Neil's book, and an update on Neil's project to manufacture a series of fuel cells to be retrofitted into cars, trucks, and buses, run on water to reduce emissions and save mileage. And on bio details for Neil. Neil Gould serves as a director of the Exopolitics Institute, founded in 2005 by Dr. Michael Sala with the assistance of Angelica Wycliffe. Neil is a graduate of the Exopolitics Institute and holds a diploma in exopolitics. An advocate of citizen awareness of the ET presence, Neil created the Exopolitics Hong Kong website. Neil has lectured at conferences across the globe on his research, experiences, and field developments. Neil authored the recently published and very popular book, Close Encounters of the ADHD Kind. His book narrates a true account of life with ADD and ADHD. Also, as an environmentalist, Neil is manufacturing a series of fuel cells to be retrofitted into cars, trucks, and buses, run on water to reduce emissions and save mileage. Website references for our listeners. First, Exopolitics Hong Kong at exopoliticshongkong.com. Exo News can be found at news.exopoliticsinstitute.org. Also, check out the Facebook pages for Exopolitics Hong Kong, Project Mexo, Neil Gould, and the Exopolitics Institute, And you'll find excellent material features the Neil Goulds and Exopolitics Hong Kong documentary channel site. They are a measure of the information produced by a son, Jake. You can find it by just Googling in Solid Gould Prod, SOLIDGOULDPROD - YouTube. Excellent site. Now, enough of me. Neil, good morning to you.
Good morning. How are you?
Just fine. I'm so pleased you're joining us this evening. Well, this evening for me, morning for you.
That's
Neil,
right.
First of all, we're all very intrigued. I want to start this program with an update on your Energy from Water project. And again, for those joining our interview at this moment, Neil's invention is a series of fuel cells to be retrofitted into cars, trucks, and buses, run on water to reduce emissions and save mileage. Neil, feel free to share what you feel comfortable with regarding your invention in this wonderful new project.
Yeah, in actual fact, we're pretty much ready to go. The only thing that's holding us back at the moment is the final set of patents. We have to patent some of this technology for one reason alone, that is that if people play around with this kind of technology, they don't know what they're doing, it can be quite dangerous. Essentially, what we're doing is we're using water, and we are splitting the water into hydrogen and oxygen. And what we do is we pollute the air with oxygen. In other words, oxygen is the byproduct. And then we use the hydrogen to inject into the engine, into the air intake of a car. So this is a splitter technology by splitting and separating the hydrogen and oxygen. Conventionally, up to now, what people in the past have been doing is using these cells, splitting water into hydrogen and oxygen, and mixing the oxygen and hydrogen together. And that method, creates the gas called HHO, or Brown's gas, when the oxygen and hydrogen is mixed together, and it becomes very, very explosive. It's very dangerous. It can lead to some, you know, severe catastrophic events for a vehicle or anybody standing by if it blows up. So our technology is completely different. It separates it all, and we have to patent the system, the technique, the whole system, so that ultimately we can license people to use it and to manufacture it safely and properly. Because out here in this part of the world, if the Chinese get hold of it, all they'll think about making the product as cheap as possible, selling as much as possible without any due care or diligence. And that's something, you know, I'm really you know, determined to prevent. So that is what we're doing at the moment. And this particular system will be used on diesel engines. So what happens is we don't use the water instead of petrol or diesel. We actually use it to complement the diesel and petrol combustions. In other words, what it does, by injecting, splitting the water and using the hydrogen, it gives the fuel a much better burn. Because what people don't realize is that when engines run on petrol or diesel, you're only using about 35-40% of the fuel, and that which you do use is being converted to mechanical energy. But by using the complementing it with the hydrogen, you get a much better burn, a much better flame propagation, and that in turn increases the horsepower of the engine, and therefore you use less pedal. So you can save, I mean, between 20-30% of your fuel costs. And at the same time, because it's burning at a higher temperature, we're actually burning out all these noxious gases. And another point is that by using the hydrogen in the engine, it actually cleans the whole engine out. It burns up all the carbon. That's an extremely useful device, and it's something that we're pretty keen on doing as soon as we can just get this last batch of patents filed. So we're pretty much there now.
Well, it sounds very much as though this new manufacturing product, this new manufacturing project, provides many benefits and projected cost savings for consumers.
Yes, it will. I mean, when I continuously hear about how in the States people are, you know, complaining about their $3 a gallon fuel going up to $4 a gallon,
yes.
You know, this sort of, if it's $4 a gallon, this will bring your cost down to about $2.90 a gallon, something like that. And it's, you know, it's a benefit for everybody. I mean, you've perhaps got the cheapest petrol in the world. You don't realize it. I mean, out here, we're probably, what, $8, $9, $10 a gallon. So, but anyway, you know, fuel is obviously one of these geopolitical tools that's being used to the pips out of us. So we've got to have something to fight back with. And I do emphasize that what this is what we call a stepping stone technology. It is not free energy, but it is a stepping stone towards it. And, of course, as we go along, improvements will be made, and ultimately our desire is to get into a more cleaner, more sustainable energy system that are steered more and more away from the fossil fuels, because that's certainly the direction that that points to those who are controlling us and keeping us shackled to this ridiculous addiction to fossil fuels.
Great comments and two excellent questions coming in from our network chat discussion room audience. The first from Glenn, a scientist and researcher. Glenn is wondering, Neil, how can your project cost-effectively separate hydrogen and oxygen from water? He's referencing the first law of thermodynamics. And Cobb, our Northeast policeman, is wondering, will this new process be feasible for jet engines?
I think jet engines is too complicated for me. We'd need some really advanced aeronautical engineers to help us down that route. But I have heard that jet engines have been helped with HHO, the dangerous form of the separation of water, of oxygen, hydrogen. In terms of the laws of thermodynamics, I mean, we get this all the time. We get all these people in the mainstream that are really, their minds are fixed on the laws of thermodynamics. But in actual fact, you know, we have systems, we have gas analyzers, we have special scan gauge tools. We plug into the car while we're driving it. For example, the most recent test for our engineers in Australia, and we have got it all sort of on video, the baseline consumption of fuel for this particular car, Subaru 2006, was 9.2 liters per 100 kilometers. 9.2 liters per 100 kilometers shows up on the gauge. When we switch on the H2, the hydrogen system, it's down to 7.2 liters per 100 kilometers. So there's a saving between 7.2 and 9.2. Now, if that goes against the laws of thermodynamics, there's nothing we can do about it. But you have to understand that the energy used for splitting the water is the excess energy that's coming from the alternator anyway, the car's running. So all we're doing is just using that extra unused current, running it through the electrolyzer cell. It's splitting the water, creating the gas. And what the hydrogen is doing, it is mixing with the existing fuel there, and it is creating a much more efficient flame propagation around the little droplets in the engine. So therefore, you must get more horsepower. So if you're getting more horsepower, you're getting more mechanical energy. If you get more mechanical energy, you're moving faster and stronger. So by taking your foot off the pedal, obviously by default, if you decelerate, you know, you'd achieve the same amount of revolutions on your rev counter that you would, you know, just running on fuel, on normal fuel without the hydrogen. So therefore, you are actually gaining, and you can gain anywhere between 50 and 30% on your mileage. Now, the other thing that we do that would also help answer this gentleman's question is that, first of all, everybody is led to believe that the air-fuel ratio in an engine, what they call the stoichiometric value, 14.7 parts of air to one part of fuel. This, they say, is the optimum, the most efficient air-fuel ratio mix. Well, we also have a microchip, which we introduce, and this is over and above what I've been telling you, that alters the air-fuel ratio to 16 instead of 14.7. So by altering the air-fuel ratio, you're using less fuel. So technically, your engine would stall because you've got more air than you should have and less fuel than you should have. And at that point, by injecting the hydrogen, you're actually making up for the lack of fuel. And the hydrogen is almost coming for free. So then you'll save even further, probably another 8 to 10%.
So you're really discussing both operational and cost efficiencies. Now, Cobb has a further question. Mm-hmm. He's wondering if, and thank you again, Glenn, for those other questions as well. Both you, Glenn, and Cobb always contribute so much during these programs. Now, Cobb also wants to know, Neil, if salt water can be used in this process or only fresh water.
Well, we're very sensitive, you know, in our three years of solid research, we've tried tap water, mineral water, salt water, you know. Everything can work, but at the end of the day, you want to keep the system viable and functional for as long as possible. We prefer to use distilled water or filtered rainwater because it is clean and you don't have to worry about any degradation of the electrodes. If you use salt water, the salt, which is in fact is an electrolyte itself, it would corrode the electrodes, and I don't think you get very much use out of the electrodes, so we stay away from it. But salt water can be used in the poor Pantone system, the GEET, the G-E-E-T, where they have a complete different way of using water for energy. But it's certainly not advisable in these hydrogen splitter cells, definitely not.
Thank you for that response. Very intriguing. Now, Neil, on the status of the manufacturing process, I did see a very interesting picture of the prototype on your website at ExoPolitics Hong Kong. Are you still envisioning using that type of car model? Is
if you're talking about the actual system, that is just a, I wouldn't even say it was a prototype. It just proves it was just to prove that you can split hydrogen, you can split water mm-hmm. to hydrogen oxygen. You know, most people find it hard to believe that you can burn water. And really, anything we've put out in the past is just to prove that point. But the system that we have, we're the first people to do this. I mean, we've spent hundreds of thousands of US dollars. We've produced injection molding tools. We've produced our own valves, our own safety systems. We have CNC machines. We have all sorts of equipment that's actually making a proper, a proper system that you could any shop owner would be proud to put in his window. So it's actually aesthetically beautiful and it's functional. It has a display monitor. It has an artificial intelligence sensor board. It has everything. It's really state of the art. I mean, it's the real thing.
Excellent. Now, Neil, what has been the response to this project of the Hong Kong community?
Well, the Hong Kong community know what I've been doing because we've had a series of mishaps along the way. We had one of our floating pontoons where we were doing the research sunk by mysterious means in the harbor, and all it went down a couple of years ago. So that sort of got around. People knew that we were up to something in this floating pontoon. Whether or not it was sabotage, it's very hard to prove. They also know because I've been talking about it in various lectures and demonstrating system for burning water. And everybody sort of is pressing me to come out with this in Hong Kong, but I must be honest with you, I'm reluctant to have the system sold anywhere in Asia in the short term. We'd like to start off firstly in the UK and America and get it going. Purely because we're worried about the Chinese getting their hands on this kind of stuff, and really, despite patents, they wouldn't have any respect for it. And as for the safety systems, you know, they really wouldn't give a damn. If they could save 5 cents, they'd make a system without a safety system, and tell everybody it was safe. And this kind of stuff troubles me. And sadly, this is the mentality out here. I've been living out here for nearly 20 years. I've been in manufacturing that time myself, so I know what goes on.
Yes, indeed, you've had several very successful manufacturing ventures. Also, Neil, how can those interested in participating in this project contact you? Through your site, ExoPolitics Hong Kong, or where?
Well, we have a website that will be going up in about a month's time. And the website will be www.quantumhydrogen.com. Quantumhydrogen.com. So when that website goes up in about a month's time, it becomes live, there should be a contact us panel that people could contact us and, you know, if they wish to make inquiries about it. In the meantime, if there's anything anybody wants urgently or wants to put the name down, I mean, they just need to email me at my personal email address, which is ngould@hkstar.com. ngould@hkstar.com. So we can always come back to you later on. But those are the two contact points.
Excellent, Neil. These developments sound very exciting. Also, final question from Cobb, our Northeast policeman. He was just wondering if you had any indicators on the horsepower that an engine using this type of system might obtain. Any indications there as to increased horsepower? Or?
You know, it's really difficult to say, you know, because every engine is different. Every engine is different. But, you know, as a rule of thumb, I mean, 10% increase in horsepower, you'd be safe to say that.
Sounds like another definite plus. Yes. Now, Neil, that's a congrats on that excellent research and very innovative thinking. Now we're going to be turning to our next item here in a series of topic discussions this evening. I note that you are co-principal of Exo News, the Exopolitics News Service. The direct link can be found at news.exopoliticsinstitute.org. Am I correct? It's directed both by yourself, Neil, and also journalist and author Paula Harris.
Yeah, we are the editorial assistants of Paula Harris, myself, Dr. Sala.
And I just wanted to give two interesting examples of this great news site for our listeners. First, David Griffin, that leading-edge researcher at Exopolitics UK, posted an article September 26th entitled First Release of Fully Translated Russian Antarctic Documentary. It sounds as though it contains, actually I read the article, it does contain great references as to Antarctica, Admiral Byrd's Operation High Jump 1947, the alleged base 211, underground Nazi base in Antarctica, and the alleged formation of the new Swabia. I hope I correctly pronounced that.
Yes.
Great article.
Well, it was quite an eye-opener, wasn't it? I mean, they even got a documentary from Russia, the Russians' version of events during the war, and had it translated into English. And I recommend everybody goes to that site. In fact, we actually have another domain. All you need to do is put in www.exonews.com. Exonews.com, E-X-O-N-E-W-S. So you don't need to sort of put in news.exopoliticsinstitute.org, just exonews.org. And that'll take you to the site. And you can read the article and you can see the film.
Very well worth the visit. And as a second example, Neil, I noted that excellent article by Dr. Michael Sala. It was regarding Steve Bassett's latest petition initiative. And just to quote from Dr. Sala, Steve Bassett from the Paradigm Research Group, or PRG, has formally petitioned the Obama administration to reinvestigate an alleged extraterrestrial vehicle crash near Roswell, New Mexico in 1947 and an Air Force cover-up of the facts, end quote, in support of his petition, which he titled Disclosure Petition 5, Roswell. Bassett cites a former astronaut, military officers, and a retired CIA officer who all believe that something out of this world really did happen at Roswell. End quote. It's a great article. And to me, it's another example of Exo News's posting of very thought-provoking and timely material at that site, exonews.com.
Yeah, I mean, it's very important we have in the Institute, you know, people like Steve Bassett, because whilst, you know, some of us are you know, totally to the thought that disclosure will never happen from governments, it'll have to either come from the ETs or the people have to become aware to burst the bubble. It's just important that we have people like Steve Bassett that are, I mean, he's tenacious, that we cover every single base, the political base, the mainstream base, the military base, the blogosphere. We cover every aspect of news information in order to bring awareness to the world about this media truth embargo. And Steve's particularly good at hammering the press, the TV, and making points like this. And he doesn't give up. He doesn't let up. And I think he's doing an incredible job. So we really have to keep every single layer covered. And that's one of the things that Echo News does as well.
Absolutely. And of course, your interviews on the web are extremely thought-provoking. Here I'm trying to, well, I want to later discuss your interview with the retired U.S. Air Force individual, George Filer. In fact, let me see if I can't just run to this now because I thought it was so very important. One second here.
I was going to interrupt you, actually.
Yes.
Because when we were talking about the energy from water,
yes,
when I omitted to tell you earlier in the past, was that my partner is a German electrical engineer. And,
uh-huh,
you know, the way we got together was quite amazing because we really come from two different backgrounds here in Hong Kong where he lives. Basically, I met him through a mutual friend, and he'd heard about my involvement with UFOs, etc. He's a very dour character, very bright. And he pulled me aside and he said to me, "You know, I just want to tell you something." I said, "Well, what's that?" He said, "You know, when I was in Germany, I was coming back from university one night, and there was this football-sized craft that flew just over my head. And it was very silent. And I was watching it for quite a long time, even till I went home, looked out the window. And this huge football-sized craft was flying very, very slowly. When I looked out the window, within a few seconds, it sped off at a tremendous speed." Now, you can imagine the guy is an electrical engineer. This doesn't fit his paradigm of physics. And he kept this bundled up in his heart all these years, and he had nobody to talk to explain about it. And the minute he explained it to me, I thought to myself, "My God, this is the man. We've got to get together and develop this energy from water system." So I just thought I'd put you in the picture there. So it makes you wonder whether the ETs are actually doing this kind of stuff. This is the mentoring that we talk about, where the ETs are helping mankind by putting people in touch. It's quite possible.
Indeed, and to me, he's an example like yourself, sir, a brilliant individual, thinking in a very innovative fashion, thinking outside the box. And I found my notes on this super interview you did. That is with Major George Filer, U.S. Air Force retired. The version I saw was uploaded July 10th, 2011, where George Filer disclosed his own ET contact. It can be found on YouTube under the title Major George Filer, USAF, retired, discloses his own ET contact. And it's posted under the Solid Gould Prod YouTube Solid Gould Productions YouTube site, again, SolidGouldProd, just then type a hyphen, YouTube, and you'll find it immediately on the YouTube system. Now, Neil,
yeah,
this was really several important items that you were able to discuss with Major George Filer. First of all, he himself had seen a huge UFO when he was in service there. Let me see. He was flying tankers over England to help refuel the aircraft. At that time, London Control started calling his aircraft to intercept a UFO that was seen. The object was huge.
Yes.
And he himself later saw it. And then you have a great vignette there about how he was invited to dinner with Prince Philip and other air crew members who had similar UFO sighting events.
Yeah, it was quite a revelation, first of all, meeting him at breakfast at the UFO convention, sitting down, chit-chatting with him. And, I was looking at him, as I normally do with people. I sometimes stare at them and wonder about them. And I was just thinking, here's a guy, he's done a lot of interviews, he's on the Disclosure Project, he was in the Air Force, he investigated that Dixieland ET shooting. It was one of his presentations that he made at the UFO conference that particular time. And I was just wondering, you know, because a lot of people who are high profile do it because they've had contacts, but despite being in the field, they still fear ridicule. They fear that everything, all the work they've done in the past and brought into the public domain could be destroyed simply because they suddenly come up and said, yeah, well, I saw a little green man or something, which is a very effective tool of the counterintelligence program. And I was just watching and watching, and I thought to myself, I've got to get Major George Filer in front of the camera. And I negotiated with him and negotiated, and finally he agreed. His reluctance was perhaps because he didn't know me at the time. But we sat him down. Jake, my son, was there filming, and started going through all the processes of what he was doing during the war and how he saw that big UFO you were talking about, which he described as being as large as the Firth of Forth Bridge, which is a massive structure that bridges an area in Scotland. And then we got talking. He started talking about Prince Philip and what have you. So I decided I would just pop that question about contact. And I did. And, well, sort of to my surprise, but not completely, he mentioned that when he was a child, and this is always hard for people to talk about when they were a child, because other people turn around and say, oh, well, you were a child, you're imagining it, you were dreaming, you were this, you were that. I mean, I know that from my experience. But he just said that he would look out of his window, because the house backed onto this park, and he would often see these UFOs flying around. And before the UFOs came, he had this sort of like a signal, if you like bees buzzing. It would be sort of the alarm, the warning that something was about to happen, which I animated in my film. And then he said that on one occasion the UFO landed, and himself and his childhood friends, neighbors, were on the bicycles. They used to play on the bicycles together. So there was the two of them. It wasn't one. It was a mass encounter. And he said the door opened of the craft, and himself and his little friend, I think was Kirkpatrick was the name.
Yes.
Floated.
Or Fitzgerald. Mm-hmm.
Onto this. And met by human-looking ETs. And we always come back to this mentoring thing again. This is one, a very, very important aspect in exopolitics, that there is this level of ET that's to be mentoring, watching, hoping, batting for us, hoping we make it past this difficult period, this nuclear age. I mean, what are the messages that were given to George Filer? It's a spiritual teachings, you know, warnings about a nuclear. I mean, imagine telling a 5 or 6 year old kid, talking about the problems of nuclear in the future, the problems of destroying the planets, you know, 60 years ago. And this is precisely what happened. And now you see all these people, as Dr. John Mack, the Harvard professor of psychiatry, said, that a lot of people who have these abductions or consenting or unconsenting encounters, they end up going out to the world and preaching, if you like. And it's exactly what George Filer does. You know, he's got his father's files, he mails, shots them out, you know, his regulars, everything, every couple of weeks. He has a 7,000 or 8,000 mailing list. He attends all the conferences, he attended the Disclosure Project. And all that he talks about must have been augmented by the childhood experience that he had interfacing with his ETs. I mean, there were other encounters he had which I didn't put into the film, and I still have the raw footage. And at some point, I'll put it together.
Excellent comments. And, you know, Neil, as well, I remember during this interview that George Filer did indicate that he feels as though he does have a type of mission, a new mission for him. And also, I thought this was really intriguing. You reported that during that meeting with Prince Philip had indicated that his uncle, the Earl of Mountbatten, had seen ET craft up close in India, and that Prince Philip believed his uncle's reports and also the reports of the crews who had seen UFOs.
Yeah, once again, you know, this is a common thing. You'd be surprised just who has seen craft and just who has had face-to-face encounters with beings, but due to the existing worldview, it is not appropriate for certain members of the public, especially high-profile individuals, to come out and talk about it. I mean, Shirley MacLaine talks about it, but now, you know, a lot of people going around saying that whatever she says now, it's because of her book, and she's a nutter, et cetera, et cetera. So you can imagine the royal family sort of standing up and admitting, oh, yeah, you know, I had this encounter, I had that encounter. You know, people would lose credibility, you know, very, very quickly. I mean, apparently the Pope at the Vatican had met extraterrestrial in the past, but that's also not spoken about. It's documented. It's very, very hard for the royal family to really come out and do much, but you notice Prince Charles, he's very green, he's very environmentally conscious. There's also a part in a book by Timothy Good, one of the workers on the estate, told Prince Philip, you know, that a craft landed on the estate, and basically the being got out and said, no, we're not going to abduct you, you know, you're too old. Kind of stories documented, you know. So it's just quite amazing who has had these experiences. And later on we talk about Project Mexa, I can tell you a few other people have had this kind of experience.
Yes, they're all very informative and intriguing accounts. And Neil, back to that topic of people's aversion to disclosing that they had seen a UFO craft or had an encounter. You were mentioning that with regard to the very rich and ancient Hong Kong culture, that there is an aversion there to admitting that they have actually seen a UFO craft or had an anomalous event, other anomalous event occur in their life.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's rather strange because it's very, very, the paranormal out here is accepted. But people will not really talk about abduction experiences as such in social events, Hong Kong people. They won't really talk about that kind of thing. A very interesting way of illustrating to you what the attitude is like. During one of the Project Mexo conferences we had here, which is an interactive conference where we had Mary Rodwell in Australia, and we'd beam her over on the Skype video and project her onto a large screen, make a presentation, and the audience would ask questions. She put forward about star children, the acceleration of human consciousness, this kind of subject, which is of very interesting to the Hong Kong people. She turned around to the audience and she said, okay, how many of you have seen a UFO? And I think about 5% of the hands went up. And she said, how many of you have had contact or seen an alien? And only one hand went up. And then she asked the question in a completely different way. She said, how many of you have seen a ghost? Suddenly 35 to 40% of the hands went up. So that just shows you how the culture takes the worldview. Under a particular way of asking that question, she then got to the nub of the realities of what these people are experiencing. So a lot of people have experienced some form of you can call it paranormal, you can call it extraterrestrial, you can call it interdimensional experience. So it is definitely part of the culture here.
Thank you for that very intriguing answer. And we're receiving another wonderful question there from COP, our Northeast policeman. And I just want to mention before his question the fact that I'd love to further discuss the remarkable sightings you have seen over Hong Kong. But back to COP's question, with the population of Hong Kong, what percentage, Neil, would you say saw a UFO or ET, and what percentage believes? Now, you already gave us some details on that, but we'd love further information.
Yeah, okay. You know, one of the problems in Hong Kong is that we have a lot of we have over 6 million people, and we're all looking up stovepipes, basically, because you have these tall buildings everywhere. Mm-hmm. So what actually does happen, these ET over here very, very often, it's very frequent. And but most people don't look up. It's as simple as that. Most people in the world do not look up. So, of course, if there's anything flying over, even if it was every minute, most people wouldn't see them because you're not looking up every minute. You're always looking in front of you. You're in elevators. You're in buildings. You're in the shadows. You're at the wrong angle. There's only a certain amount of sky that's available. So that is a huge factor in limiting what people see. Now, when we do get the sightings, it happens to be when people are on the beach. We've had quite a few experiences of these, like, stars that come over during the day, and little orbs, maybe two or three, will join together and suddenly shoot off at high speed. We have instances where we have colored lights one on top of the other that hover around for hours. You get the windows in the apartments, see them, photograph them. And we can't tell what percentage of people, because the population is spread into a huge amount of different stratas, which involves, you know, different, if you like, different income groups, different educational levels. We have very extreme here. We have highly educated and we have no education. And it's very difficult to say what percentage of overall people see UFOs, but there's a growing number of people who are, you know, more and more learning English and being exposed to media and asking questions, and I get a lot of emails all the time, is that I saw this, I saw that in the sky, what is it, what could it be? It is something that is in its infancy here, but is definitely a strong movement being underpinned here. It is growing, and more people are also becoming educated, because in China, not only are we having sightings in China, but we're having these really, what you might call these particular flyovers are actually interfering with the air traffic.
Yes.
News. Because it's not like, you know, they don't sort of say, oh, you know, maybe it was a kite, or maybe it was a flying fish or a swamp cat. They say it was a UFO. Okay. Close that. So this is adding to their understanding and opening their minds that, you know, it is now reasonably okay to start to discuss this kind of thing. I mean, you know, there is this like duality that exists here. On the one hand, you have a serious population, but on the other hand, if you look at their own culture, they have this obsession with the dead. You know, when their relatives die, they go in there, buy paper money, they burn it because they think the relatives are going to get the paper money. They want to buy their dead relative a car. They get an effigy of a car, they burn it, and the car goes up and the relative drives a car. Well, I mean, you know, if you can accept that kind of thing or think that way, then it's not a great jump to start to accept that, you know, that there are higher life forms flying around, not only, I mentioned it,
and Neil, have you finished that excellent response? I know with the Skype connection here between myself, Colorado, and yourself in Hong Kong, and Joe in Louisiana, there are tremendous distances entailed, so I hope I'm not cutting in there. We have another further intriguing question from Cop. Now, he has been working on a survey on individuals' area who have viewed a UFO or ET, and also as to their perceptions on these subjects. He's wondering, Neil, if these individuals in the Hong Kong area, when they do see a UFO or anomalous craft, see it during the day or night. Also, he's wondering if you've seen a triangle or triangular-shaped craft, how large was it, and the speed. And I think that's wonderful. It segues right into your details on the 2000 and 2007 sightings of the giant V-shaped, triangular-shaped, or chevron-shaped craft seen over downtown Hong Kong. So let me just kind of break this down into bullets. One, do they see most of these craft during the day or night? And also, we can get into your great sightings there on that Chevron craft.
Yeah, there's no real difference between day and night. You know, they appear, mm-hmm. they can appear anytime. You know, I mean, I've seen them more often between 5 and 8 o'clock at night. That's just my personal time that I've seen them. I've never seen a triangle. But yes, Chevron craft, definitely, and you know, I'm talking kilometers wide. That I have seen on numerous occasions. But if I just may break in with a little quick story, just very not too long ago, I was invited for dinner in Hong Kong, and I only realized when I got there, I was invited really to be antagonized and perhaps quizzed, criticized or whatever by a scientist and his wife, who was a psychologist. They were invited round as well, and I think the game was to pin me against the wall and, you know, really make a joke of the evening kind of thing. Well, what actually happened, I got there, and this family who hosted dinner, they had this 13-year-old child who was sitting there, And they started going on about, well, how can you prove this, and it's nonsense, and blah, 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 and scientifically it doesn't make sense, and how could they get from over there to over here? And there was something in this about that evening that really ignited some kind of emotion in me. I can't really explain it, but it was a kind of a disappointment. And when that happened, I got this very, very intense feeling. It's very difficult to put into words. When suddenly the kid on the right-hand side of me said to his dad, "Dad, is this all true? I'm going to go out, look out the window now and see if see if I can see a UFO." And he ran out onto the balcony. And after about 10 seconds, he came in screaming, Dad, there's three craft outside the window that just flew past. They're yellow in color, blah, 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 blah." And he was going crazy. They couldn't calm this guy down. This kid was going mad. The parents got very, very concerned, very, very worried. The son dropped, although he didn't see anything. His wife, who was a psychologist, changed her tune completely and supported the idea that, you know, the kid was so disturbed, something must have happened. But cut long story short, after that evening was up, my wife and I, we came down in the elevator from 20th floor to the ground floor. We went outside to catch a taxi home. And when we looked up, just above the building was a tumbling barrel, between a barrel and a cigar shape, or like you might say, like one of those medication tablets. Tumbling, it came tumbling over our heads. We saw it for 5 seconds because it made sure that we could see it until it got lost on the horizon of the buildings. So these are the kind of experiences that seem to happen around here. Now, going back to 2000 sighting, 2007 and 8 sighting, in 2000, that was something that I've never seen ever since in my life. You know, it's four of these huge, massive, kilometer-wide craft at 800-foot altitude. As I keep mentioning, I calibrate that from the height of the IFC building here. Came out silently, beautiful gold spheres underneath, the colors you cannot imagine. They seemed to burn something into the mind. It seemed to remember memories from the past. It had an effect on me. There's no question about it. And 20 other people watching too, including the governor of a very well-known day school here. They flew over silently, stayed around for hours. And I was expecting, you know, we'd see something in this on the news the next day. Of course, nothing was mentioned on the news. But anybody who was in the harbor would have seen it. And nobody's ever mentioned it since. It's never been reported anywhere. A lot of people still think I'm a nutcase because I even, you know, to speak about it. But the fact is the fact. It was seen. It was there. 2007 was a different Chevron craft that came over in front of my family and in front of friends. And it's So these are events that are happening. How much time you prepare to dedicate, look up at the sky, I guess, you know, because that's where they are. They're in the sky, and you see, they want you to see them, not because you're lucky to see them. Process does raise us. Even the fact that I'm talking to you and explaining to you what happened, thousands, and becoming more open to it, and the more open to it, qualify, if you like, to be not classified. He's going to shock. You know, if you saw something, and the chances are you will see something. Or the chances are there when you see, but you'll put it down to a real possibility that what you were looking at was something extraterrestrial.
Thank you for that response. And I'm asking the UPRN chat room now if they can fully hear us speaking. I know there's a little bit of pinging action going on. Again, that would be the distances. Thanks, Steve. I appreciate that. No, I guess they're hearing us loud and clear. Thank you, Steve. Now, lots of questions. At one point, if you'd like to take a break, that's fine, and just name your time 5 to 10 minutes where we started late. But, you know, talking about the mainstream markers, receiving evidentiary marker or UFO craft. You mentioned in a great Banal of America interview a couple of years back the fact that the observatory there at Hong Kong has experienced interesting observations on these unknown craft. If I remember correctly, was it about 40 per year?
Yes, it was around that. You know, the problem with all these things are that every time you talk to the observatory, they send somebody out to come and speak to you. So you might get a kid who's maybe just qualified, who's only been there for a year. He'll come out and he just tells you what he wants to tell you. You know, he may not even have ever heard of a UFO before, but he said the only time he heard about it was when his boss told him that, you know, people are reporting these sightings. So you get all these quirky characters coming out of the observatory every time talking to you about a different thing. The key people don't really really want to make a big issue of it, and they tend to want prefer to, especially recently, you know, be reported as maybe a laser or something from a light show. You know, I don't really, I mean, they do admit that there are these reports, that people are reporting anomalous objects and stuff. It's most difficult for them, because if they don't see it, they can't really report it as something they've seen as well. So just the world view takes over, you know. The safest, play safe, that's, if you're an employee of the observatory, you better not say it's anything too strange, otherwise people will lose credibility in the observatory. So that is quite a possible motive for these kind of answers these days. But having said that, if you go now to China, to Guangdong, you might be aware of this, there's the planetary astronomer Wang Xishou of the Chinese Academy of Sciences at Purple Mountain Observatory. He's the guy who's been talking a lot a couple of years ago when all the talk was about UFOs over, you know, in China being made public, etc., etc. And he sort of made headlines when he predicted there'd be a lot of UFO sightings. But he basically says that these sightings cannot be explained by existing scientific knowledge or natural phenomena. So big hint from, you know, Wang Xishou of the Purple Mountain Observatory. So it's a growing, you know, people are waking up. People are waking up everywhere.
Thank you, Neil. And, you know, as to China, I just wanted to mention the interesting airport sightings. I believe they might have been referenced in a prior interview, but though we usually like to concentrate on Hong Kong and Hong Kong sightings. However, I note here an ABC link. The title, it is from Fresh Report of UFOs Over China Marks Eighth Time Since June, and this is from the abcnews.go.com/international/fresh-report-UFO-China's-skies. And it's interesting because it mentions the several sightings, and let me see here, the print here is rather tiny for me, but it mentions sighting over, oh, I wish I'd marked this with a yellow pen here. Sometimes my eyesight is poor now. Just within the last few years, I have macular degeneration, but that's rather a recent development. How do you pronounce it? Shaoshan Airport, I believe the operation. Tell us about it.
Okay, well, basically that happened in July the 7th, 2010, the Shaoshan Airport incident. But let me just tell you that it's near a place called Hangzhou. Shenzhou Airport is part of the Shanghai Triangle Hub. There's like those three cities in northeastern or more eastern part of China. It's a very, very important hub, because in that hub is an area that is really concentrated on a lot of factories, a lot of industrialization. So it's a pretty busy hub. There are more flights over there than anywhere else in Asia, if you like. Very important flights too. Now, in March, just some months earlier, 2010, there's also the Hangzhou Car Company. And on the internet, you can see there's the CCTV camera in the car company. And what it does, it sort of points over the factory area in the yard, the huge area where they park all the cars. And it clearly shows two anomalous objects. They're apparently red in color, and they float over the sky, and then they shoot off. Now, this was actually out of the CCTV and placed on the Chinese equivalent of YouTube, which I think is called Tudou. Then, in July the 7th in Hangzhou, which is about 180 kilometers southwest of Shanghai, an unidentified flying object, as they are called, flew over the airport. The flight was preparing to descend. I think it was July the 7th, around, I think it was 20 to 9 at night, when the air traffic control notified craft something in the area, and vice versa. The craft was talking back again, and they could see it, and they decided to ground all the flights, divert the inbound ones to Bimbo, the other part of the triangular hub. And this became an issue because there was something in the sky. It was not an aeroplane. It was not a balloon, a blimp. Nothing could fly over China. Now, it's fortified with radar, with spacecraft, etc. The whole airport was shut down. And I actually heard through a particular that this was a CE2, a close encounter of the second kind, because there was a trace. A trace meaning that the radars had problem working, something interfering with the radars. So it did attract the Chinese media, the great storm. So it became pretty important. But then, September 2010, same thing happened again at the Mongolian airport, which is about, it's a Batu airport, B-A-O, Batau, it's pronounced Batau, I think, in Mongolia, the 13th of September. At 8 p.m. that evening, or thereabouts, a craft seemed to appear from nowhere over the airport, and the same story, they shut the airport down. And it happened again in May 2011, Thai, which is in Shandong, which is maybe just a few hundred kilometers east of Hong Kong. People noticed these strange lights, and they were talking about these white dots in the shape of a big V. And a couple of people apparently have not seen the film. And then the V-shaped chevron, as it were, flew off again. And then on March 15th, I think, not March 15th, I can't remember the date of that, but in Kunming, which is a very important city. It has an astronomical observatory, and it's sort of like has institutes of higher learning, the Yunnan University, Medical College, etc. They had a huge sighting. Apparently this thing was massive, a couple of them. I don't really know much about the shapes, etc. But this caused another stir. Then we had the Taipei 101 in Taiwan, a particular huge disc that appeared over the building. When they appear, and you know, you've got to ask yourself why. And my real hunch is that this has possibly got to do with these countries holding these nuclear weapons. These ETs don't like it, and I mean, they raise people's consciousness. They're flying over and showing that there's something else, something larger. And we know about the ETs interrupting the missile systems in the States. Well, the same thing happened in China. So that's just a brief summary of what's been going on.
That information is really fascinating. Thank you. And Neil, should we take about a 5-minute break now, or should we continue straight to about maybe 20 minutes before the hour? What would be easier for you?
Yeah, I'm okay.
Excellent. I am too. Neil, should we next approach your book? It continues to receive a great deal of response, and then there's several further interviews I'd like to ask you questions on. They were remarkable. Okay, now go into your book, Close Encounters of the ADHD Kind, ADHD, referencing Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder. Now, Neil, you are a persuasive and dynamic advocate for your causes, whether the ET presence, exopolitics, free energy projects and innovations, and also regarding the possible correlation of ADHD and alleged ET encounters. Do you think that, and I believe you can far better summarize this than I can, do you believe that some experiencers receive knowledge capsules from ETs which endow them with particular perception and awareness traits that allow them to maximize activities and concentrations on whatever career or academic field they pursue.
In my book, what I assert is that some, not all, some, be very careful there, because of course there are pathological problems. Some people do have dopamine problems, etc., morbidities, one problem behind another. What I was saying in my book was that some, not all, some cases of ADHD, people are misdiagnosed, where it's really not ADHD, and you know, these people have difficulty concentrating, but it's come about as a result of contact, of encounters. Now, whether the encounters are happening in the forms of dreams, whether it's happening in the form of face-to-face, is irrelevant. The fact is that there is this interface between ETs and humans directly in many cases. And what it does, once you've had this kind of experience, your abilities to perceive multidimensionally increase, your abilities to calculate, to fathom, to handle any issues that are in conflict with the worldview, or even enables you to extend the boundaries of the worldview. This is all a result of contact. And when you see some of these ADHD kids, and I've spoken to quite a few teachers about this, they have a lot of these kids that are extremely destructive in class, and they're very difficult to discipline. But what they've found with these is that at home, their families don't know how to cope with it, and what they do is they basically drug them. Whereas in fact, when they add extra stimulus to these kids, they find that it's the stimulation that they need. That these kids have a tremendous capacity in their perceptions, a tremendous capacity in their abilities, their calculus, and they just need stimulating, and they're extremely bright. And this is where, you know, we have this conflict with, I mean, I'm labeled ADHD. I may very well be partly ADHD, but certainly the greater part of me has got to do with having the contact experiences I've had, you know, throughout most of my life. This great awareness. I mean, how can you be normal when you, you know, when you're living in a world where everything is put into a box? You go to university, you're trained, you pay your money, they teach you what they want to teach you, and then you write exams and you prove back that you know what they've taught you, and you are you qualify, and you cannot go outside of those barriers. You cannot go into the metaphysical world. You cannot go into the paranormal world. It doesn't exist. It doesn't exist. But when you've had contact, if you've seen up a UFO, people like Mike Bird you've interviewed, been the same, Grant Cameron, these great researchers, they come out of having experienced something outside is really to show you that somewhat I can't say much normal middle of the road guy, but I certainly give a general sort of easy introduction into seeing life through my eyes, if you like, how these miscellaneous events that have occurred in my life have shaped my worldview. And then I slowly bring in the experiences of others like Gordon Cooper, Dr. Michael Wolff, Mary Rodwell, Dr. Edgar Mitchell. I bring in little paragraphs, little phrases as you go along through the chapters, and slowly reinforce the direction that I'm getting you towards, until finally bringing you to a point where you can see that the reality is totally painted in, and that there's a much greater rich depth of reality in the reality we live in, and we are not being allowed access to it. So tech does heighten your perceptions, and ADHD, or let's say ADHD is a generic word given to both those people who are really do have a pathological problem, and those people who have benefited out of this understanding that there's a great reality out there, comes into conflict. And they all labeled under the same label.
And as well, Neil, you note that positive traits for ADD and ADHD include the capability to assume risk and break rules, to create one's own paradigm, and heighten awareness of a multifaceted universe. And, you know, the record of your career achievements reflects this, being able to incorporate the knowledge from various factors, marketing, maritime law, also joint ventures to really produce an excellent business record and many achievements.
Yeah, well, this, you know, you're talking about this downloading and knowledge bombs, etc. I mean, Mary Ruddle does talk a lot about this. Many of her, and she has 2,000 clients. She knows what she's talking about. And she really does, her clients have mentioned the same thing that I'm mentioning, that you get downloaded. It's not words. It's not words. They're like templates for which you draw. You know, sometimes they're useless for the moment. But as you go later on down the line in life, you can draw on them. And you're talking about this, you know, I mean, first of all, this worldview being disruptive, etc. These programs really create this. It's like having a rebellious gene in certain people. These programs create this kind of rebellion. So you're actually rebelling against the mainstream. You're rebelling against convention. For example, if you're forced, like I was at school, to go and sit in the morning assembly and pray, you know, this rebellion gene suddenly, or program, turns around and says, well, look, that are these guys doing. They're all just following each other because they're told to. They're closing. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with communing with your creator. Don't get me wrong. I'm just talking about the mainstream version of God that they give you, the sort of control mechanism. And you rebel against this. You suddenly say, well, what are these people doing? Why are they prostrating themselves on the ground? Why are they performing these rituals? And this is the problem when you live with this kind of, not a problem for me, I mean, I quite enjoy it, but you challenge everything. And by doing that, you make space for other people. You push the boundaries. Like people say, the laws of thermodynamics, you can't have hydrogen engines increase mileage. Well, you know, hello, you can. And when you do and you prove it, it makes space for others to move into that area. And what happens is you have this civilization, if you like, evolve. It's a catalyst for evolution. And that's exactly what ET contact does. It's exactly what the mentoring does. It's exactly what the UFO sightings are there for, and what contact's all about, is to create this great catalyst so that we can shed a lot of the garbage that's put onto us by, you know, by religion, by politics, by the military, by the politicians. And we slowly peel away these layers of nonsense, and we start to reveal a truth. And people start to resonate with that truth. As their consciousness rise, and it also helps it to rise, we start to evolve into a different society. And, I mean, you can see now, I mean, over the last 20, 30 years, just how fast time is passing, how we don't have to make trunk calls anymore. We don't have to send telexes anymore. We don't have to send faxes anymore. You know, send emails, but we don't have to do that anymore. We have real-time computers running. We have business with transactions, business being done. The crops are being grown. Everything is speeding up. We're doing more and more and more in so little time. And what has to happen, it has to be an upgrade of the human psyche, of the human ability, of the human mind. It has to be this new kind of new human that has to be able to take its place. The kids are in there with their computer games, working at hundreds of miles an hour in their brains, solving problems. You know, this is a very important factor to understand, that we are still evolving, we're still moving forward, that eventually a lot of the politicians are not able to keep up with the way this evolution of humanity is going. They're not able to keep up. We are able to see through them now. Internet. It's such an incredible tool. You can use it now to talk amongst themselves, like Facebook, for example, and pass opinions, you know, with each other. We'll eventually be able to circumvent money. We'll be able to circumvent the use of money. We'll be able to barter over the internet. I'll give you some of this if you give me some of that. I mean, this is where it's going. It's extremely important to understand this, that nothing is going to remain the same.
Powerful arguments there, and I very much would like to discuss shortly the great lecturers at Hong Kong Exopolitics. You've had such guests as Mary Broadwell discussing her thoughts on the new Homo Noeticus, also Jim Sparks, and also I'd like to refer back here to your excellent description of the download phenomenon. And just here, I want to Neil as well for being a great director for ICAR as well, for Hong Kong. And, of course, ICAR were the first to discover the download phenomenon. And right now in the room with you, and they're really appreciating this conversation, is, of course, Joe Montaldo, UPRN network owner and international director of ICAR, as well as our new North American director, Jason Wilson. And, boy, we love hearing the download factor and its importance described as aptly as you are so doing. Now, Neil, before we go back to some of your further great interviews, I wanted to mention as well the fact that your son, Jake Gould, was able to obtain interesting results with use of a laser pointer, and then the virtually immediate appearance of anomalous or UFO aircraft. And also at your ExoPolitics Hong Kong site, you show part of a CSETI meeting with Stephen Greer and staff at an unknown state, it looks like, in France, where with the use of lasers, they also obtain remarkable results.
Okay. We'll start off with Jake's situation. And like I told you, when I was invited to that dinner with the scientist and his wife, and I had that incredible, powerful emotion in me, you know, when you know, I realized what the game was, and then the UFOs started to appear. That true, pure driving intent was sort of vectored from my body, and that's what caused, or my mind, and that's what caused those UFOs, in my opinion, to turn up in front of the kid and when we went downstairs with my wife. Now, with Jake, he went to Amsterdam with a few of his friends. And of course, they've obviously heard a lot about our involvement in ufology, but they really didn't believe it, and they had a chance to sort of pressure him on his own to see, you know, what was the truth behind UFOs. Anybody can just go to YouTube and put in Jake Gould UFO Amsterdam in the search box of YouTube, and what you'll see happened. He didn't use a laser, but there again, it's this emotion. When people challenge you, you get to a certain point where you disturb, deeply disturb on a pure form of emotion. And that, in my opinion, is what caused that craft that you see in the film to appear. And he had the camera and he said, "There it is, boys. It's there, look." And he was filming it. And they were all absolutely amazed. It was a typical disc. If you look at it close up, you'll see that it's flip-flopping and spinning. And the interesting thing was all his friends saw this. They've never been the same since. When he brought the film back to Hong Kong, I inverted the colors. And what we saw on YouTube is that there were actually two craft, one in the visible spectrum and one in the invisible spectrum, the infrared spectrum. So that was like, you know, a double whammy, a double proof that they were there. So that's on that particular basis. Now, Stephen Greer uses these the three protocols, really, for CSETI. One of them is using sound, and the other one is coherent thought sensing, using consciousness as an interface, which I totally agree with. The use of the lasers really is to sort of, you know, if you see a craft, you flash at the craft a couple of times, and if it flashes back, then obviously it's a human-initiated encounter. It can be counted as a CE5 because you've initiated the encounter. Craft is there, you flashed twice, it acknowledged you and flashed twice back. On that particular occasion in France with Dr. Greer, we had a real series of events happening. I mean, we had some of the cars parked in this field, and rather strangely, the lights of the car started to flash on and off on some of the cars. Some people said, "Oh, well, you know, maybe it's on the keyring. There's a button you can push." All of a sudden, the interiors of the cars flashed. Parts, with interiors. So that shows that there was some intervention going on there. We also had a beam of light that appeared momentarily in the circle, flashed on and flashed off. But of course, on that occasion, I filmed these trans-dimensional craft that seemed to materialize just below the crust point of light, the central magnetic field. If you look in the film, you've got to look very, very carefully against the background of the trees, and you can sometimes see the sparkling appearing. And those craft, when you look at them, you can't actually see them, but you see like a mist with a few sparks. And you can see other people commenting in the film. And that was sort of about 5 o'clock, so it was still quite light. But later on in the evening, we had these really weird experiences. I mean, pillars of like plasma or smoke that you could see. And Dr. Greer was saying that, you know, those are these ETs standing around everybody. A misty shape of a disc landed. Stephen Greer walked off, told us to stand behind, and he walked off into that mist, and he seemed to disappear. He really did seem to disappear. And he came back, and he then called us to follow, so we had to put down the cameras. We weren't allowed to take anything on board. Basically, you're entering somebody else's domain. You've got to respect it. Had to put our arms down and hold our hands open in front of us, and we all walked towards this mist. And when we, on the way, we're about 30 feet away, we could smell these, like, I mean, this is in a cow field, for God's sake. You normally smell cow dung, you know? You could smell the beautiful smell of roses, of flowers. It was very, very intense. And everybody slowly approached this mist, and we all walked into it. And what had actually happened, we were inside this trans-dimensional craft. Now, I couldn't see any people inside, make out any dashboards or monitors or screens, or all I could perceive was that we were inside this mist and we could see each other very clearly. But some people were saying that they could see more. They had the ability to see, maybe they'd cover a different part of the spectrum, I don't know. But then we heard this this peeping sound, and we didn't know what it was. And I was standing next to Stephen Greer, and he had his compass in his hand, and the sound was coming out of his compass. There's no doubt about it. And it started to go beep, 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 beep. And then he realized, he said, my God, he said, they're sending us their pulse. This is the heartbeat. So that was quite an incredible revelation to watch that. All this happened in France, all happened in a CCETI event. This is not about lasers. This is, this is about people vectoring emotion together, and like. And the signature tune of SETI is owned by these ETs, because they do these events every week all around the world. And the ETs come, you know, you step up to mark, they meet you halfway. So that's obviously what's been going on.
Thank you very much for that detailed response. And on a tangent, lest I forget, I wanted to note to our audience the excellent collection, free downloads of articles and books at your Hong Kong Exopolitics website. And am I correct here, Neil, that one of Clifford Stone's books has recently been translated into one of the Chinese dialects?
And that was the Jim Sparks book.
Oh, mm-hmm.
Yes. And Clifford Stone, I just recently made the film with, edited the film of Ed Komarek. Remember, he interviewed Clifford Stone. Film.
Yes.
Outdated camera, and I had to find somebody in the depth of Kowloonia who had old equipment and had to unravel the film and basically rebuild it. Animated the film. So, pretty good film to watch, because I've put in all sorts of animation that explains clearly what Clifford Stone's job was all about and what he encountered.
And may I ask a question? Would that be available at the Exopolitics Hong Kong website or at the Solid Gould Productions, Solid S-O-L-I-D G-O-U-L-D P-R-O-D page on YouTube?
Yeah, and all people have to do is you put Neil Gould CCETI, you'll get the CCETI film. If you put Neil Gould Clifford Stone, you'll get the Clifford Stone film.
Mm-hmm.
And the other recent one I did was The Son of Billy Myers. I interviewed the son
yes.
of Billy.
That was very intriguing as well. That was with Methuselah or Methy Meyer. Very thought-provoking, his discussion on Figu, the Billy Meyer team there. Very interesting. I thought, too, it was very fair that you referenced that the son doesn't dispute that his father did have contacts with a group of extraterrestrials called the Plajarans. Interesting interview.
For me to just, because, you know, I don't want to throw it out of the bathwater.
Mm-hmm.
Contactee, and unfortunately, what happens to contactees is you get your mind messed up sometimes by human elements sometimes by ridicule, who knows? But unfortunately, I think from what we see in that film is that the FIGU group of people have really taken over the Maya case, and to a large extent are not very nice people from all accounts, from what I can see. And I'm still in touch with Mehdi, and we're trying to make a second film because some new evidence has come to light as well.
Excellent. And also, I wanted to reference the Exopolitics Hong Kong lecture series you have up at your Exopolitics Hong Kong, and also that YouTube site. The presentations given by Mary Rodwell, also Jim Sparks. Your interviews with them are outstanding. Also, I want to shout out here to Jake for his interview posted in June 2010. I believe it was done the year earlier because Jim Sparks wanted that year interval. It's entitled Future Humans and Off-World Humans, end quote. Very intriguing. The discussion that Jim Sparks has with your son, Jake, as to these humans 300 to 500 years away in evolution from us, allegedly, and also on the humans much farther away, the off-world humans.
Yes, that is very interesting. That one sitting up here with Jim. It was amazing because he said, look, I really cannot get out. Some of it runs into conflict with David Jacobs and all these kind of that are human. They've been born off planet and they back to Earth and evolved to people don't realize, you know, that there are real humans. But it's a very complicated whole. This whole field becomes so complicated because one person's to contradict another person's research, and it's very you have to grasp some aspects of all this. But you know, I feel we have to record it and put it out in different interdisciplinary processes, can take parts of it, react to it, and come to some conclusion.
Thank you. Very interesting comments. I hope I'm not breaking in there. I'm having a little difficulty hearing, but I'm going to ask the audience again in the room if they can still hear this great discussion from Neil. And also, Neil, I'd like to reference here that very innovative project, Project MEXO, M-E-X-O. Also, would you give some details as to one of the Hong Kong principals, in addition to yourself, a lovely lady? I'm trying to think of her name. Moon. She's seems like a wonderful spokesperson.
You mean Miao?
Yes, I'm sorry, yes.
Yeah, okay, well that's, yeah, because what, she's very talented in setting up conferences, if you like. She's very talented from that point of view. She knows how to set up an event and take into account the fact that, you know, you have people who don't speak English, and she went through a hell of a lot of work to receive presentations ahead of time from people, and then she would trot into China as the person's talking in the presentation, flash up the screen, the Cantonese of what they're saying, and flash the slide. So now the work went into that, and Dr. C. Scott Jones, there is a promo, and it was so good that we made a two-minute promo, or a summary, if you like, of the Dr. C.B. Scott Jones presentation. So once again, on YouTube, if you just tap in Project MEXO and Dr. C.B. Scott Jones, you can watch what Dr. Jones, summary of what he had to say and what he was talking about. And, you know, I think, I don't know if you know Dr. C.B. Scott Jones, he was...
Yes.
He was an intelligence commander. He was part of the Rockefeller Institute to get the White House to open up on... The Rockefeller Initiative to get the White House to open up on UFOs. Well, he was really saying that he thought China would be the best country to lead disclosure because they're against weaponizing space, allegedly. They've been to the moon. They know what's on the moon. Their past civilization has been rich in culture and technology and the arts. Basically, people don't really talk about it. He just sort of felt they'd be the right crowd of people to break the cartel, if you like, get out there. And he spoke a lot about, this is very important what he spoke about. He spoke about while he was in the intelligence services, an open visit to China in the 1990s. And he visited, one of the places he visited was the Society for Semantic Sciences, which is an institute in China that studies extended human capabilities. Take it very, very seriously. Paranormal, extended human abilities, qigong, all this kind of metaphysical stuff. So, the Institute of Somatic Science, they believe that by understanding and reforming the world view, if you like, on the metaphysical world, it would bring a tremendous benefits to mankind. So, they actually claim. And theory of relativity. So there's a whole set of events, if you like, I can talk about of what C.B. Scott Jones experienced with these Qigong masters, you know.
That sounds very interesting. And also, Neil, please pardon me if you'd like to repeat anything you just said during that loud noise. What I was doing, I'm ashamed to say this, I wanted to be able to give the direct link for one of Meow's Project Mexo's YouTube by translations in Cantonese and English, one of them related to Dr. C.B. Scott, and I'm sorry, Scott Jones, and I'm sorry that loud noise that loud tune just was heard, but it looks like a wonderful sight. So,
I'll tell you what some of the things quite important that he spoke about, because it really shocked the audience.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
When he went to the institute, met these Qigong masters, he was really accompanied by some really top-level Chinese people, and actually witnessed the Qigong masters using qi, this paranormal energy, if you like. And he found how the decay rate of isotopes were influenced. In other words, if there was radioactivity, they could bring it down with their minds. He also went on to hear about, you know, the healing of broken bones. I mean, he couldn't actually witness that, the speeding up of the healing. But what he also was witnessing was this PK, or psychokinesis, where objects were put in these sealed glass containers and they would be able to be passed through the walls to the outside. I mean, this all came from C.B. Scott Jones. He witnessed this kind of stuff. He also had a person, one of the masters, where 220 volts, some very high current, was enough to kill any human being, was passed through one of these Qigong masters, who then put his hands on Scott Jones's shoulders and act as a transformer. So he would lower the current coming into his body and releasing it as a trickle of energy into C.B. Scott Jones's shoulders. He could feel the energy coming through the Qigong master without getting electrocuted. And he also went on to talk about experiments that they were doing with dolphins. And he's saying it wasn't all classified. Some of it was not classified. He was talking about how dolphins would be able to use telepathy to determine where something was hidden, in sort of which jar something was hidden, and they go straight to the jar if thoughts were put out. He was also talking about the star children, where the Institute of Somatic Science trains them. You know, they in the States, I believe, if anybody's got extended human ability, he picked up, weaponized, put into a program. But in China, they actually nurture these people, these kids. And the kids there, I don't know if you remember recently, there was a kid with Chinese kid with gray eyes that could see in the dark. These kids are brought in, and their abilities are assessed, and they're helped along. And one of the kids in China that he saw could actually read through the armpits, through underneath the armpits, by putting under the armpits on words, they could read the words from the armpits. So it's rather strange experiences and a very, very strange evening we had with Dr. Scott Jones. But what was extremely significant was that he was talking about how the Chinese told him that their nuclear missiles are also deactivated, just the same as Captain Robert Sala's missiles were deactivated in the States, and many other missile sites in the States are deactivated by these UFOs. The same is happening in China, and of course, no doubt, it stands to reason that the Russians are also being interfered with.
That's very important information. Neil, as I remember it, Dr. C.B. Scott Jones is was employed with the Office of Naval Intelligence, and that he actually had war room presence and service. Very distinguished individual.
Yeah, yeah. Very, very interesting guy, and he actually he was allegedly a Palladian, and I've had some communication through C.B. Scott Jones with this extraterrestrial individual. He doesn't hide it. He's recently mentioned one of his articles somewhere. And he gets a lot of information, and he works with this, with Monitor quite a lot. Really, really stands by what Monitor says. So it's another interesting revelation of an ex-naval intelligence officer is working with an E.T.
And that institute information and their presentations really sounds very intriguing as well. But am I correct from your interviews and from your writings that the Chinese scientists are very willing to conduct serious research in fields that might seem to be a bit anomalous or unusual?
You know, I'm sure every country is doing this, you know, but some of different countries regard it as classified. Some countries don't regard classified, or they may classify parts of it. For example, a lot of the remote viewing is still classified. And in China, they talk about remote viewing, but, you know, I mean, we really don't know the depth to which China and all these countries are involved in this paranormal. We really don't know how deeply involved they are and what they're keeping to themselves and what they're letting out. It's a very, very hard area to navigate, because at the very, very top of all these countries, there's this, as Ed comes, this group of people that are controlling the alien resource teller. Ed comes. That's all the, from extraterrestrials, this back engineered material, these technology programs, use it to study, they use it for geopolitical control. They create huge divide between us and themselves. I mean, they have world humans already. I mean, this breakaway civilization. You know, this whole exopolitical picture is very, very complicated. It's huge. It's wide. And you can see from Ed Komarek's book, because you did mention me some time ago, it's extremely complex. And Ed does his best to try and unravel the pieces and give everybody a little bit of information so that you can research it further.
Indeed, and if I remember correctly, the title is UFOs, Exopolitics, and the New World Disorder. He will be a guest on October 19th, the first hour. Now, Neil, if we could return to the project MEXO, M-E-X-O Initiative, the excellent work that you're doing, also Ms. Miao, I noticed that there have been very important postings at that site. For example, the recent Rents interview was noted with Dr. Ken Johnston, who in 1969 controlled, as is mentioned, all of the photographic information and data generated from the lunar missions at the Lunar Receiving Laboratory. So noted, and great discussion there on the unusual monuments or unusual possible facilities seen on the backside of the moon. I'd love for you to get to go into further details on that, and also Project MEXO itself. It's an initiative where you can hold conferences with the panelists speaking on the internet and immediately broadcast through the world, and with also real-time feedback from the listening audience.
Yeah. He's a very interesting guy, because I mean, the first time I heard of him was some years back when I think Richard Hoagland brought him to the forefront. I'm not sure. He released all these photographs, which I have on disc, that prove that there are these the remnants of these meteor-spattered glass domes over some of the craters. And some of his photographs show where you might not see the dome, but what you see is the crater, and you see these prism lights, and they go on to how the prism can only happen if the sun's in a certain position and if it's shining through glass. That's how you prism, and how the astronauts, you know, basically you can't see a lot of stuff in the background because everything's white and manufactured. And well, I mean that interview is very interesting. And Ken John, I mean, we know. Sergeant Carl Wolf also talks about, from the Disclosure Project, how you walk into a room at NASA and pictures of the moon are sanitized. I mean, it's disturbing for me personally. I just find it very, very upsetting that all these truths are just, covered up and in the hands of so few people. I mean, I'd like to personally be able to get hold of Ken Johnson and maybe make a film, and it'll bring a little bit more out into the public domain, because I think he holds a huge amount of information. In terms of Mexico, it is a difficult process, as I said to you, to have a speaker talk for 1.5 hours, to have it all broken down into Cantonese, because it's not a question of taking English and putting it into a translating machine. You have to translate Chinese from English using meaning, what you actually mean. And then it's put up on the screen, and every presentation takes 500 slides, which you get that clip on Dr. C.B. Scott Jones that you mentioned just now. And yes, basically for 1 hour or 1.5 hours, depending, the speaker makes a presentation. Jim Sparks spoke about time travel. He spoke about how being taken from his bed when the craft is stationary, as opposed to being taken when the craft is moving at just below the speed of light. He includes that in terms of time travel. He talks about how he goes up into the craft for 2 hours, but when he comes back, it's like only half an hour went by. He relates that to time travel. He brings in many examples of how he was brought back once before he left. In other words, he's sitting on his couch, he saw them bring him back, and he saw himself standing in front of himself, and then he was pulled. So that was a very interesting presentation on Mexico by Jim Sparks. So he gave his presentation, it was translated, pictures were put up, and the audience were then able to ask questions, because we have a panel where the questions asked in Chinese, it's translated into English, and Jim then understands the question, and then it's translated back to Chinese to the audience. We also had Neil Freer, the futant or paleoanthropologist, or everything. Neil is a very knowledgeable man, talking. He made a presentation on the tremendous presentation, and it really, Hong Kong people love that. There were thousands of questions on the Anunnaki, and that went on for 3 hours. Then we had Mary talking about Star Children, the new human. That went down very well as well. And Mary using psychology, as I mentioned, to show people that depending on how a question is asked, depending on what your mindset is, determines what your, and how your culture is, determines on what you perceive as an alien or extraterrestrial or as contact. And that was a brilliant presentation. Then, of course, C.B. Scott Jones made his presentation. We haven't had one since then because we had a break, and I've been very busy with my energy project, so it seems to tie my ankles to the floor somewhat. I seem to be really involved with this, just trying to put the finishing touches to everything so we can get going on it, because it's 3 years of work and it's now time to get it moving. So a brief summary on Project Nexo.
Much appreciated. And now we have about 2 minutes until the conclusion of the program to at least give 10 minutes time for network promotions. I want to thank you so much, Neil, for your time with us this evening. I know doing it in a straight stretch can be arduous, and boy, you were an excellent interview guest. I only wish myself that I had your intellectual stamina. You really produced a great deal of intriguing and thought-provoking information. Now, in a final 2 minutes, would you like to just note your final comments and any new developments at your websites? And I'd like to note them again for our audience. That would be the first one for Exopolitics Hong Kong at exopoliticshongkong.com, for Exo News at Exopolitics. Could you get that for me? News.com? Exonews.com.
.org.
I'm sorry, exonews.org. Again, exonews.org. Also to check out that 2-page, and just take it away, Neil, your final comments.
The question was, I just think that, it's very, very important we have people come into this field more people being educated in this field. And I just really wanted to tell people that I think that the Exopolitic Institute certification program is an extremely, extremely important method of learning about the extraterrestrial presence, of understanding how this worldview is limited, extremely limited and controlled. And I really believe for those people who come to the Exopolitics Institute and you know, do this course online, work with Paola Harris, Manuel Lamoroy, Dr. Sala, I'm sure, absolutely sure beyond all doubt, that it will change your life forever. You'll become more aware. You'll be able to understand things better, to put things into more perspective, to understand the mainstream political spin and interpret it into what it really is all about, what they're really trying to say. And all the lies and mistruths that are out there will be put into perspective. This is just one personal thing I wanted to tell everybody. I think it's very important to really try to contact the Institute. You can do it through myself, whatever, and get onto some of these projects.
Okay, well, excellent conclusion. Neil, I hope so much you'll be a very soon return guest. We very much appreciate the time spent by our listeners each Friday. We appreciate very much your being present for this interview. Thanks again to our researchers in the room for great questions. And Neil, again, thank you so much for a wonderful interview discussion. As always, your information is excellent. Very, very thought-provoking. Anyway, great weekend all, and you have a great rest of your Saturday. Saturday, well, it's later morning there now in Hong Kong. Great day to you, sir. Good night, all.